Paul, let me ask you something. Do you like your family?
It's a really complicated question, Steve. I didn't realize this is where we're going to be going right now.
No, I mean, do you like seeing pictures of your family?
Yeah, sure. Pictures of my family are nice. Yes, sir.
Okay, I've got a great recommendation for you. It is the Aura frame. You've probably seen some of these before. You go to your friend's house and they have a frame on the cabinet or in the living room or whatever, and it has digital photos.
Sure. Yes.
Well, I got this thing and I set it up, super easy to set up. I basically dumped a bunch of photos from my phone right onto it. Very easy to do. Took me just minutes.
Oh, that sounds scary to me.
No, it's incredibly easy.
It's not hard. Okay.
And basically you can put seems like an almost infinite amount of photos on this thing. And then you can set the parameters and it can rotate your family through every 30 seconds.
Amazing.
And it's great because I've got pictures of my son, my family.
Cool.
My dad passed away a few years ago. I get to see him popping up every now and then. The good ghosts of your personal history coming through on this thing.
Nice. That's nice.
They have a great deal for Mother's Day, so listeners can save on the perfect gift by visiting AuraFrames.com to get $30 off plus free shipping on their best-selling frame. That's AuraFrames.com. Use code ChinwagPod at checkout to save. Terms and conditions apply.
Chin wag.
Chins a wagon.
Chins are wagging all across the nation.
People still ask me, what does it mean? And I just got to say, people, get out there and convert people to the understanding.
Get out there, just tune in, people, and you'll understand. I was actually amazed at how uncommon it seems to be to people.
Yeah.
I guess I'm weird because we knew what it was, but I didn't. I thought maybe it was a more common phrase in America, but it's not. It's very
British.
It's
good for people to adopt a new vocabulary terms.
It really
and so
is.
let's try to make it stick.
I think we should try as much as we can to get people to adopt Britishisms. I'm going to call the windshield in my car the windscreen on my
the
car from now on.
And the boot of your car?
Yes, and the boot of my car. And the next time I want a wrench from you, Steve, I'm going to ask you to hand me a spanner. All right?
Yes. Wait, will I get that from my garage?
Is it garage? Is that they say garage? Yes. And then I'll wrap it up in aluminium, which is aluminium. And then we'll drive the lorry to... Here we go. The pavement. They don't say sidewalk. And then trousers. We'll have our trousers. We'll have our trousers, of course. What else is there? There's a lot of other...
Oh, so many.
My favorite thing they do is the whole... Do you ever see the name Chalmondele? That's how it's spelled. Cholmon. It's a Chalmondele is the word, but they pronounce it Chumley.
What is it?
It's a name. Sort of name. And it's but they pronounce it Chumley.
There's a hilarious line that... that George Orwell says, he's making fun of, he's great at making fun of everybody, but including his own British compatriots. And he says, British men refuse to pronounce French words properly, lest their sexuality be called into question. So they mispronounce it all in this ridiculous way.
Mispronounce it, yes, so they'll be macho.
It's really funny.
Yeah, well, that makes sense in some way. I could see guys doing that. So you don't want to look any foreign language. You don't want to look like you know some foreign language. Well, speaking of what? That was not a good transition. Speaking of what?
it doesn't matter.
apropos of nothing, we're going to, we're back with some listener mail is what we're doing here. And I think we have one to read, Steve, that I believe you were going to read for us.
We have an interesting letter here.
Yes, take it away.
Rick B. Mm-hmm. As I think longtime listeners know of this show, we are interested very much in matters of alien intelligence and alien existence. And Rick B. Writes in saying, I'm wondering if you guys have ever heard of the Drake equation.
I have not.
That is a very interesting thing. I looked it up after reading Rick's letter. Mm-hmm. It's SETI inspired. And so I should just define what SETI is. I think a lot of our listeners might know. It means the Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence. And this was a group that Carl Sagan was a part of back in the day.
Right. Does it still exist?
I believe it still exists, but it's probably been shrunken down to a basement somewhere in a NASA
office. It's like a strip mall in Orlando somewhere, just with, with an old a tin can and a string. Oh, dear. Poor guy. It's
in the basement of a Denny's or something. Okay, so he says, it's a SETI-inspired probabilistic argument used to estimate the number of active, communicative, extraterrestrial civilizations in the Milky Way. Mm-hmm. And he says, the part I thought you might have fun with, fun might not be the right word, is the L in the equation. And L stands for the number of years an intelligent civilization remains detectable. Hmm. So let me quickly say what the Drake equation is, and then I'm going to finish his letter, because it'll make more sense if I can say what it is.
Okay.
It's basically an equation developed by a guy named Frank Drake in 1961.
That sounds like a fake name. That sounds like a pseudonym. I know, but
he's real.
Frank Drake.
Frank Drake. It does sound like a from Central
Just
Casting.
On the fly, making up a name. Yes.
He says, okay, N is the number we're trying to arrive at. And N is basically the number of civilizations in the Milky Way galaxy with which communication might be possible. So this is just like how many places have intelligent alien life that we could talk to. Okay. And he says it's a function of all these variables. And the variables, it's a long list here, but it's you'll understand it right away. It just says you have to say that number is basically the average rate of star formation in our galaxy times the fraction of those stars that have planets, times the average number of planets that can potentially support life, times the fraction of planets that could support life that actually develop life, times the fraction of planets that life go on to develop intelligent life, because that's obviously a big difference, times the fraction of civilizations that develop a technology, times the length of time for which civilizations release detectable signals into space. So that last one is L. That means in order for us to contact another alien civilization, they have to be broadcasting some signals that they're out there. And so the question is, how long could a civilization broadcast its presence through technology? And so
until they do themselves in
So then Rick says we are the only intelligent civilization we know of, and we don't know how long we will remain detectable. A conservative estimate for this value would be 50 years based on our own experience to date. Drake felt that 10,000 years was a good guess, but that was in 1961. I believe we're talking about the end of our civilization here. So here's the fun part. He says, what do you think would be some of the factors we would employ to quantify it? Some likely candidates might be climate change, the rise of technology, specifically AI, and misinformation. What do you say? Best Rick B.
Oh, boy. So he's saying, what is it that's going to end our signal?
Yeah, and how long can we keep it going?
Oh, we must be putting out, is SETI putting out a signal? Is SETI just like, is SETI, didn't we, what's the thing on the, is it on Voyager, that like plate that has like the sort of engraved like, stuff, right? Isn't that Voyager that's sent out?
I think almost everything they send out now has some sort of time capsule information, like songs and poems and stuff,
and like a Three Musketeers bar and like some kind of just like just
Twinkies.
Twinkies. It would be Twinkies. Did you ever hear, though, just here's a real side. I one time heard that, you know, because Twinkies are this thing that supposedly don't need to be cooked. It's just the combination of chemicals cooks them, that there's no cooking
required.
And it lasts
forever.
Yes. And then I once heard, and I don't know if this is true, and I'll get back to the letter in a second, that in the Twinkie factory where they're making the Twinkies, people get Twinkie lung because they inhale these chemicals and it cooks and it creates a coating of Twinkie matter inside your lungs.
That's horrible.
It's like black lung for coal miners. They get Twinkie lung. I don't know if it's true or not, but I remember hearing that.
It should preserve them for a very long time.
Yes.
It's like your whole inside of your lung is like microplastics, like a layer.
Yes, exactly. That's exactly right, except it's Twinkie. It's Twinkie cake inside of your, it's like, so he's saying, what's now there? He's saying 50 years 50 years from now, and it will end because we're going to be done in by one of these things.
Yeah, like I think politicians could wipe us all out by just blowing us all up.
Well, that certainly seems like an increasing policy, increasing probability, right? I mean, that doomsday clock thing, have you been reading about that recently?
That's right.
I guess it's the closest to midnight it's ever been in the past few years, right?
That's scary.
It's really scary. It's really scary because, I mean, now they're not... You know, they're these little warhead things. You can just lob one of those really easily. It's not like you got to fly the Enola Gay over a thing and drop Fat Boy and Little Man out of a, out of a thing. Jesus. You got to like...
Fat Boy.
Right? Isn't it Fat Boy and Little Man?
I think it was.
And, you got to like, you can just toss one of these things, not a big deal. So that to me seems like the most likely thing, doesn't it? I mean,
but do you think, let's imagine there is like a nuclear holocaust of some kind. Okay, we're getting dark here, but
I know.
But I have this feeling that there's going to be, and maybe it's because I've watched too much science fiction films, but there's going to be some small cadre that goes underground. They're there now. They've got silos and shit. They're going to still like,
they're all billionaires. They're all trillionaires.
Yeah, right. This is what I'm saying. Like these guys, like Elon
Musk. Yeah, I don't know that it will end it. Yeah, what you're saying is I don't know. Yeah, and that's the thing is that I don't know. Man is a resilient beast. God bless him. And, it's like, I mean, all of this, you're like, it seems to me like it would certainly go beyond 50 years. I mean, even if
I think
we
so
had
too.
A...
I think 10,000 years sounds possible.
More likely?
It seems possible.
Yeah, I mean, it seems like it.
Because even if we mess up the planet really bad, we'll live in domes or
whatever.
Underground.
We'll live off planet or something. I mean, 10,000 years. If we make it 10,000 years, surely we'll make it a little further than that, right? I mean, it's like, if we can make
what's
it
what's that great song, In the Year 2525?
In the Year 2525, if man is still alive. Who is
classic.
That?
Classic.
It's so classic. Who was that? God. Well, that's
sounds
boy.
Like Burl Ives, but I don't think it's
it
Burl.
It wasn't Burl Ives. No, it was more like, it was some kind of... trippy psychedelic band. It was like, Strawberry Alarm Clock or something. Wasn't there a band called something?
There was.
Or like, Three Dog Night or something like that. It just feels like one of those things. But what would be this AI? But I don't feel if AI is going to take over, I don't know why AI wouldn't continue to probably...
To send signals.
Send signals. So it's like, I don't think they're going to end anything.
And if there's this theory that if a civilization got really sophisticated, it would create what they call a Dyson sphere. Mm-hmm. And the Dyson sphere, which is named after Freeman Dyson, physicist, is that we could create some kind of structure that would harness the power of the sun and then be able to use that power like a giant battery. Mm-hmm. And so people suggest that if a civilization can do that, it would leave a pretty big like a fingerprint to be seen, like some kind of evidence. You'd see that, a galaxy away.
Right.
And so humans might be able to create some kind of giant sort of mirror type. Of course, one theory is we should just shut up. We should be very quiet. So we
Why?
Don't get
Because
detected.
You don't want to invite some dude to come and destroy the planet.
Listener, it's Zach Harper, Amin El-Hassan, and Anthony Mays of Cinephobe. You may be asking yourself, what is Cinephobe? Amin, would you like to fill in the people?
Cinephobe is the podcast where Zach and I watch movies that are poorly rated on Rotten Tomatoes and try to ascertain.
Ascertain?
Yes.
Okay.
Ascertain. Whether or not they're accurately poorly rated, or maybe they didn't get a fair shake. Cinephobe, produced by this guy, Anthony Mays.
Hey, that's me. I produced this show. I also watch the movies, even though that wasn't included in the description, and I also ascertain. This month is...
Whoa!
Oh, Maze, why do you say that? Supercharge it. So that this promo can remain evergreen.
I feel like explaining a little bit more.
In 60 seconds?
I don't know. Maybe I don't bring attention to it. Assuring people like, look, if you listen, you're going to get it. Just give it time.
That's a good promo. Just listen to it.
Give it time.
You'll figure it out.
Is this the promo right now?
Isn't it? Okay, I think we got it.
Cinefo.
Wherever you get podcasts.
Monsters are as old as humanity itself. Monsters embody our fears. Yet, they help us define the boundaries of what it means to be human. We know most monsters aren't real. Yet we can use monsters to learn about reality. Psychology, biology, folklore, literature, critical thinking. We're on a journey to learn about the world through the lens of monsters. And we hope you'll come along with us. Subscribe at monstertalk.org.
You believe that there's intelligent life elsewhere, or life at
least. I do, yeah.
And intelligent.
I think the probability is there.
Right? It just seems too, weird that this would be the only place, right?
Yeah, that's my view.
Yeah. I think we brought this, didn't we bring this up with somebody in one of these?
Where I remember, we were in a live show, and I thought we were talking about this in a live show,
I feel like, too. And I think I was going about that thing that I was always saying when I was a kid, which was, well, nothing, you know, Paul, nothing can live on Venus because there's too much methane. And I was like, but what about a thing that lives on methane? You know, and everybody,
Right.
And I'm like, you know, why do we know? I mean, the definition of life just seems, you know, as we define it, biological life, you know, obviously methane, we kill everything. But, you know, I suppose it doesn't make any sense.
Life is resilient and very strategic. It can grow. And I think that, I mean, there's one theory that says, like, you need more time than we have to, like, because if you look at the Earth, if it's only been around for what, I don't know how many, like 4 billion years or something
like that.
And Earth's been around for like life has been around for 3 billion years, but it was basically like algae, like soup for most of that time.
Crazy.
And then they think we're only going to maybe get another billion years before the sun gets so hot that it boils the ocean.
Is that right? Is that how much we have is a billion years?
Well,
and
I've
then
heard
the sun
that,
expands
yeah.
and yeah, right. As the sun goes supernova, the sun goes red giant and all that stuff. It like,
well, but I guess like that's like 10 million, that's 10 billion years, but just 1 billion years might
make getting
the
hot
Earth
enough.
Uninhabitable. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
So the window of opportunity for an intelligent technological expansion is actually more narrow than we thought it was, if the Earth is a good example.
Wow. That's a trip to think of. Holy cow. Oh, man. There's a really good, it just made me, when you were saying resilient life, I reread recently a really good science fiction book, a weird science fiction book, and actually not an easy science fiction book to read, called Dragon's Egg.
Oh, what was it?
A Dragon's Egg, it's called, and I can't remember the name of the guy who wrote it, but he's a physicist, which doesn't lend itself to being great. Great literature. Well, no, but it makes itself being good science fiction. It doesn't lend itself to being great literature. I mean, he's not the greatest writer
no
in the world.
No character development.
He's not the greatest writer in the world, but it's an interesting book about life developing on a neutron star, which is, you know, these as stars collapse in, as they're dying, the neutron star is, I guess, the step before a black hole. Right before it sort of like collapses in on itself. So it's this super
dense. And
there's
like white dwarf too.
Dwarf and stuff like that. And so it's like this super dense star. So this crazy civilization develops on the surface of a neutron star that is like, it's like Flatland or something.
Oh,
you know,
cool.
It's like, because they're so
really
flattened
cool.
to the, yeah. So, but it's really, it's kind of great because this sort of elaborate civilization grows up, and there's a fantastic first contact story in it too, with these guys make contact with these kind of almost microscopic things that are living on the surface of this. It's a good book. Yeah, it's good. But the idea that something could live in that kind of place, you know what I mean? In these environments that we'd think it would be impossible for something to live. I mean, the fucking fish that live at the bottom of the crazy
Those volcanic holes at the bottom of the sea.
Yeah.
And then there's like animals living down there that were, you know, just astounding.
The fact that we fucking have made it this far, that we exist at all, have made it this far.
It's true.
You know?
It's true. But I think that's true. Like whenever people create science fiction narratives, they always sort of make them look humanoid. And it wouldn't look humanoid at all.
No,
they'd look, like you said, single cells or spiders
something. Yes, or whatever. Not even anything we could conceive of.
Yeah.
Which is really a cool idea. Like something inconceivably weird looking. So
or
alien.
Like that's what like that Stanislaw Lem idea in Solaris is, the whole planet could be a conscious being.
Right.
That's really cool.
That's really trippy. The entire thing is a sort of conscious being. And its power, it's so powerful that it kind of invades and takes over other people's consciousness.
Yes.
Too, in that thing. Because it's sort of just, it's pure consciousness. So it just leaks into anything else conscious around it, which is really, Jesus Christ.
It's kind of creepy when you think about it.
It's really creepy. Yeah, it's super creepy, actually. It's a very creepy concept. Wow. Well, there you go.
Okay, Rick.
That was something, Rick B.
Well done, Rick.
I like that one. That was cool. Yeah, I've never heard of cool. the Drake. Yeah, that was really cool. Keep them coming. Keep them rolling in because it's always a good time.
Yeah.
Always inspiring. And as always, chin waggers.
Wag on.
Nice.
Chinwag is a production of Treefort Media and Touchy Feely Films, hosted and executive produced by Paul Giamatti and Stephen Asma. Executive producers for Treefort are Kelly Garner and Lisa Ammerman. Dan Carey is executive producer for Touchy Feely. Our series producer is Rachel Whitley Bernstein. Original theme music by Luke Topp, with additional music by Via Mardot. Oscar Guido is our executive in charge of production. Tom Monahan is head of audio for Treefort. Audio production supervision by Matt Dyson. Editing and mixing by Jeff Neal. Animation created by Alex Sokol. Research assistance by Aiden Brooks. Lastly, for more information, go to chinwagpod.fm and find us on Instagram or TikTok at chinwagpod or on Twitter at chinwag_pod.